So I want you to imagine just for a second that you're digging through your phone, trying to find a really specific photo.
Oh, yeah, the endless scrolling.
Right. But instead of the photo, you stumble across a text draft. And it's this intensely emotional, devastating message to an ex or like an estranged friend from 20 years ago.
Oh, wow. That is a gut
It
punch.
really is. You poured your heart out, you warned them of some impending disaster, detail exactly how you're going to handle it, and then looking at the screen, your blood just runs cold.
Because you realize you never hit send.
Exactly. You never sent it. And even worse, that exact same crisis you were warning them about, it has just shown up at your front door today.
That is just a paralyzing feeling. I mean, finding the physical or digital, I guess, proof of a massive unresolved moment in your life, it just immediately rips you out of the present, you know?
Oh, totally.
It forces you to confront a past that you really thought you had outrun.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Welcome to today's deep dive into the Chronicles of Mirari.
Yes, so glad to be getting into this.
Me too,
Yeah.
because we are sifting through this truly massive, just fascinating collection of fantasy journals, historical logs, and scholarly accounts from this incredibly rich realm.
It's like an overwhelming amount of lore.
It is. But for you listening, our mission today isn't just to recount some, swords and sorcery adventure. We are looking at how history, myth, and these deeply personal choices intertwine to shape the present.
Yeah, and the world building here is spectacular, but you're absolutely right about the core focus. The most compelling thread running through all these documents is how deeply they explore the burden of the past. It's really a study in how old mistakes, ancient betrayals, and like forgotten warnings never actually
They
vanish.
just go dormant.
Exactly. They just wait.
So whether you are trying to navigate some impossibly complex office politics right now, or you're just endlessly fascinated by human history, this deep dive is going to offer a masterclass in how unresolved conflicts always find a way to resurface.
Absolutely.
So let's set the scene. We are in Hawksmoor Keep. This is this formidable fortress built high up in giant trees.
Right on the border of those terrifying woods.
Yes, the inky black, malevolent woods where absolute nightmares roam. And deep inside this fortress, we find the archives.
I have to say, I love the description of these archives. They are wonderfully, terribly disorganized.
It's basically my nightmare.
Right. There is no head librarian keeping things in check. You've got maps, ship's logs, ancient histories. They're just piled high on these massive oak tables.
Just everywhere.
Yeah. But there is a very specific, almost tragic logic to the chaos. Basically, the books that were recently used are simply tossed on top, while the older, perhaps more vital histories get progressively buried at the bottom of the stacks.
It's the perfect metaphor for human memory, honestly.
For sure.
I mean, we keep our immediate day-to-day problems right on top, and we just, bury the deeper traumas under a pile of distractions.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. But Thomas, who is an explorer and the founder of the Golden Hawks, he's forced to dig. He reaches into the back of one of these dusty piles and pulls out a tiny, unmarked book from year 39.
That's where he finds it.
Yeah, out flutters this unfinished, unsent letter addressed to Lady Redmayne.
And in that letter, Thomas lays out a desperate plan from 2 decades ago. He writes about a solitary mission he felt he absolutely had to take to breach a place called the Destroyer's Keep.
Just the name alone is terrifying.
Right. His goal was to stop this horrifying entity known as the Jack of Hearts.
The details Thomas puts in this letter are incredibly vivid. He's plotting out a route through places with names like the Bridge of Sorrows, and he talks about these wildlander rumors of an iron dragon dwelling in the Icejaw Pit.
Yeah, the world building is so specific.
It really is. He even mentions needing a highly specific source of light to ward off these shadowy, creeping beasts called Drew.
Oh, the Drew. Creepy.
Very. But what really strikes me is his tone in the letter. He insists on taking this journey completely alone to, in his words, spare the lives of his friends.
Which is such a classic hero complex.
Totally. So, standing in that archive 20 years later, holding this unsent letter, Thomas realizes history is repeating itself. He's preparing to face the exact same danger today.
Yeah, the Jack of Hearts is back.
Right. And it hits me that Thomas might just be projecting his own massive guilt here. I mean, he went alone last time, and it was a disaster.
That survivor's guilt is really the driving force of his character. When Thomas went off on that lone wolf mission 20 years ago, his close friend, Captain Randall, refused to just let him disappear.
Because that's what good friends do.
Exactly. Randall mounted an expedition to follow his route. hoping to either save Thomas or, like, at least recover his body. But Randall's group was overwhelmed by a desert storm in the wastelands, and he died.
Wow.
So in the present day, Thomas is standing in that dusty room, reading the actual logs of Randall's doomed search, just whispering apologies to a ghost.
That's heartbreaking.
If we synthesize this, the broader theme becomes painfully clear. Isolation in the name of protecting others often leaves those very people profoundly vulnerable.
Because you take yourself off the board.
Yes.
Thomas thought he was taking the burden solely on himself, but his sudden disappearance created a vacuum that basically drew his friends out into the very danger he was trying to shield them from.
It's the ultimate tragedy of the lone wolf hero trope.
It forces us to ask whether acting alone is ever truly selfless or if it's, you know, actually a form of hubris.
I lean toward hubris, honestly.
Same. Well, the physical weight of these past mistakes, literally buried in dusty books, suddenly shifts into a very present, heated moral debate. Because another character enters the archive, shattering the quiet.
Here comes Hannah.
Yes. Hannah, a young companion of Thomas, walks in. She's traded her rough traveling clothes for fine red linen, but her demeanor is pure steel.
She is not messing around.
Not at all. She brings a completely different kind of tension to the room, forcing Thomas to defend a highly controversial choice he just made.
Hannah is furious. I mean, absolutely livid. She has just learned that Thomas allowed someone known as the Dark Witch to go free.
Which sounds like a terrible idea on paper.
Right. The Dark Witch, whose real name is Alyssa, was formerly the Bandit Queen. And Hannah is demanding justice. From her perspective, this is incredibly straightforward.
Bad person does bad things, bad person gets punished.
Exactly. The witch terrorized and killed people in the Golden Woods using dark illusions and brigands. So Hannah wants her to pay with her life.
But Thomas reveals his hands are tied by the past. He argues that he is bound by a 20-year-old oath.
These oaths always come back to bite them.
Always. Back when Alyssa was just the Bandit Queen, Thomas made a desperate deal with her to protect his followers. As long as Alyssa didn't harm his people, he promised he wouldn't hunt her down.
A very pragmatic choice at the time.
Sure. But he adds another layer to this, arguing that Alyssa was essentially a pawn, manipulated and twisted by the Jack of Hearts into becoming the Dark Witch.
Right, shifting the blame.
And to try and calm Hannah down, Thomas throws out this philosophical analogy. He asks her, would you kill a wolf if it perhaps slain a villager?
It's a very pointed question. And Hannah doesn't hesitate. She says, yes, absolutely, if the wolf was inclined to kill again.
I mean, hard to argue with that logic.
True. But Thomas pushes back against the idea of executing something just for acting true to its nature. He urges her to respect different behaviors, pointing out that she has no idea what trauma or circumstances shaped Alyssa's life before she became the Dark Witch.
He's asking for empathy.
Yeah. He warns Hannah not to be so quick to deal out death.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I am not entirely buying Thomas's defense here.
No.
No. Is Thomas actually being noble and enlightened by sparing the witch? Or is he just stubbornly clinging to a past mistake because he feels incredibly guilty?
That is the big question.
He even admits his oath to the Bandit Queen wasn't his grandest moment.
Yeah.
Honestly, it feels like he's using high-minded philosophy to cover up the fact that he's completely paralyzed by his own past.
He can't move forward.
Exactly. Think about modern office politics. For those of you listening, how often do you see a manager refuse to fire a toxic employee just because they were the one who originally hired them?
Oh, all the time.
They invent all these philosophical reasons about, like, giving people grace when really they just don't want to admit they made a bad call 5 years ago.
What's fascinating here is that the Chronicles leave room for exactly your interpretation. We are witnessing a fundamental clash between two wildly different concepts of justice.
Well, let's get into that.
So Hannah represents retributive justice. This is the oldest human instinct, the idea that a crime creates a deficit and it requires a proportional punishment, usually violence, to balance the moral scales.
An eye for an eye.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Thomas, however flawed his motivations might be, is advocating for a form of restorative or nuanced justice. He is looking at the causality. He is asking why the wolf bit the villager rather than just reaching for an axe.
But does looking at causality actually solve the problem of a dark warlock running around the woods?
That is the ultimate tension. But Thomas gives Hannah a very specific, practical warning that elevates this beyond just a theoretical debate. He tells her she needs to be incredibly careful with her hatred.
Right, because the Jack of Hearts, the Destroyer, is still out there.
Waiting.
And Thomas knows that if Hannah lets this black and white hatred consume her, the Destroyer will use it against her. He could offer her the vengeance she craves in exchange for her loyalty.
Harboring pure, unyielding hatred makes you a magnet for manipulation. The true enemy doesn't just attack you with swords and fire, he attacks your grievances. He finds your anger and weaponizes it.
Which is such a brilliant transition into the lore itself.
It really is.
Thomas and Hannah are standing in this archive debating who is truly to blame, the pawn or the player. And elsewhere in the sources, there's this fascinating scholarly lecture taking place that breaks down exactly who or what this ultimate manipulator is.
Yes, the lecture.
We have a character named Lady Iseult lecturing a young girl named Agatha about the origins of the Year's End, also known as the Destroyer.
Lady Iseult lays out three distinct origin theories for this ultimate villain. And the fact that there are three completely different histories highlights how terrifyingly ambiguous the threat actually is.
You fear of the unknown.
Exactly. So the first theory is almost primordial. It suggests that the Year's End is an ancient fundamental evil of Mirari, something that existed long before the Fae or humans ever arrived.
Like it's just baked into the soil?
Yeah, a part of the land itself that operates like a natural disaster.
Wow. The second theory is significantly darker, I think. It suggests that the Destroyer is the entire reason the 12 houses fled their old world and came to Mirari 53 years ago.
The apocalypse theory.
Right. The idea is that they were literally running from an apocalypse.
Yeah.
And that apocalypse simply tracked them across the sea.
Then you have the third theory, which is entirely human and political.
And so petty.
Very petty. It points to a specific historical figure, Lord Aeon of January. According to this legend, Lord Aeon helped tame the new land of Mirari alongside the early leaders. But when he demanded the throne and was denied, his pride just shattered.
He couldn't handle the rejection.
Not at all. He attacked the ruling family, fled into the wilderness, and vowed to destroy Mirari out of pure spite. His motivation is essentially distilled down to, if I cannot rule it, I will destroy it.
Whichever origin you believe, the methods this villain uses are pure nightmare fuel.
Oh, absolutely.
The Chronicles describe him as a shape-shifting warlock who never wears the same face twice. And his minions are so specifically terrifying.
The minions are the worst part.
We mentioned the Drew earlier.
Yeah.
These cowardly shadow spies about the size of dogs or badgers with flat tails.
Shadow badgers.
Yeah. They just watch from the dark. And then you have the Vaglari, which are these horrifying scorpion men with lobster claws and paralyzing stingers.
Ah, no thank you.
It's an overwhelming array of terrors. But looking at all these varied, contradictory myths, the giant scorpion man, the shape-shifting, the ancient evils versus the spurned politician, I have to wonder about the psychology of the people writing this down.
How so?
Well, Lord October, another character in the text, basically suggests that maybe they are just blaming a faceless villain for their own internal political infighting. Are they just inventing a boogeyman because it's easier to blame a shadow demon than to look in the mirror?
This raises an important question about how societies function under stress.
Right.
Historically, whenever a society is deeply divided, it almost always projects its internal dysfunctions onto a single mythological scapegoat.
Because it's easier.
Way easier. It is infinitely easier to say a dark warlock is manipulating our trade routes than to admit our leaders are corrupt and our economic system is failing.
Classic deflection.
Lady Iseult even acknowledges this temptation in her lecture, but the texts strongly push back against the idea that he's purely symbolic.
He is very real.
Yes. In Mirari, the Year's End is a very literal act of threat. And what makes him an existential danger is that he doesn't need to invent conflict. He just finds the cracks that are already there and pours poison into them.
It makes me think of modern social media algorithms, honestly.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. The algorithm doesn't create the anger. It just finds your existing biases, feeds them, and weaponizes them to keep you engaged. The Destroyer operates the exact same way. He thrives on deception and treachery.
Absolutely.
Now, having established this terrifying, ambiguous villain who operates from the shadows, we finally get a concrete historical account of someone who actually fought his forces head on.
Finally, some action.
And it ties right back to the very beginning of our deep dive. The recipient of Thomas's unsent letter, Lady Redmayne.
While the Year's End is shrouded in myth and psychological manipulation, Lady Redmayne's story is a vivid, brilliantly grounded chronicle of action and consequence.
The text gives us this incredible tale from year 36. Redmayne shows up at a tourney as a black knight. She has completely unmarked armor, no family device on her shield, and she wields this beautiful rune-etched steel.
So mysterious.
And she has a strict code. She refuses to draw her blade against the Fae folk, only against monsters. So she's patrolling the snowy borders in the dead of winter, and she comes across a group of trolls who are baiting and torturing a magnificent white stallion.
Poor thing.
Single-handedly, she slaughters the trolls and strikes the heavy chains off the horse. But when she pulls out a halter to lead him away, the horse aggressively refuses.
The dynamic between them is established instantly.
Yeah, he is not having it.
The stallion allows her to clean his terrible wounds, making it clear he understands she's a healer and an ally. But he draws a hard line at being leashed or subjugated.
And the lore gets so good here.
Yeah.
Later, after this stallion ends up saving her from a secondary troll ambush, he actually speaks to her telepathically.
Which is wild.
It is. He reveals that he is a Hearn Lord of Horses. He proudly declares that he bows to absolutely no one, mortal or fey, and swears to no master.
He is his own boss.
But then, because Redmayne genuinely respects his freedom and starts to walk away on her own 2 feet into the freezing snow, he steps in front of her. He chooses to let her ride him.
It's a powerful narrative about earned loyalty versus demanded fealty.
Really beautiful.
Together, they form an incredible partnership. They clear the land of trolls, they slay a dragon, and eventually Redmayne is granted her own land.
A happy ending.
Well, almost. She builds massive stables where Ahern's folk can weather the brutal winters, and she retires to live a quiet life. And that peace lasts until year 39.
Wait, year 39, the exact same year Thomas wrote his unsent letter.
Yes. And this is when Redmayne receives a series of incredibly eerie, unsettling visitors. The tone of the Chronicles shifts completely here into, like, a creeping thriller.
It really does. The first visitor shows up wearing a pale cloak, completely hiding his face. He offers an astronomical, logic-defying sum for a score of her broodmares, but absolutely refuses to say what he wants them for.
Super sketchy.
Redmayne immediately turns him away. Then a few days later, a woman arrives. She claims to be an emissary from House December, but she has fake credentials and demands to take a dozen horses.
Ahern wasn't fooled, though.
Nope. Ahern telepathically warns Redmayne not to trust her, and she kicks the woman off her land. Finally, weeks later, the ultimate threat arrives at her door. A third visitor.
This part is so creepy.
He's cloaked, he keeps his left hand entirely hidden, and he's riding a headless, eight-legged beast.
It's just a terrifying image. After speaking with this nightmare rider, Redmayne realizes exactly what is coming for Mirari. But look closely at her response here.
Okay.
When faced with an overwhelming threat, the instinct of most leaders is to hoard their power, right? To consolidate their resources and build a fortress.
Yeah, circle the wagons.
Redmayne does the exact opposite.
She writes warning letters to the Queen and to the Golden Hawks. And then she walks out and opens the doors to every single stable, barn, and pasture.
Just lets them all go.
She aggressively chases her beloved herds out into the wild so they can be free. She arms herself and her Hearn with heavy armor and her rune-etched lance, and she rides north alone to meet the threat, never to be seen again.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the philosophical contrast is stunning.
So what does this all mean for the realm of Mirari? Look at the beautiful stark contrast between the ultimate villain and the ultimate hero.
Exactly.
The year's end, the Destroyer, commands his forces through manipulation, twisting people's hatred, and unnatural subjugation. But Redmayne leads entirely through mutual respect.
She literally refused to leash Ahern.
Right. When the ultimate darkness came to her door, her first instinct was to grant freedom to those she loved, rather than use them as shields.
And this is why we study history. Because in Mirari, history isn't just locked away in dusty, disorganized archives. It is a living, breathing mechanism.
It's happening now.
Yes. Toward the end of the sources, the young scholar Agatha notes that rumors have started swirling again in the present day. Wildlander scouts are reporting that a great white stallion has been seen leading the wild herds in the Green Hills, moving with a distinct, intelligent purpose.
It gives you chills. Because Redmayne made the agonizing choice to free her horses all those years ago instead of hoarding them, Ahern survived. Her legacy of freedom is exactly what allows him to potentially return and aid Mirari in the present day.
It's a remarkable tapestry of lore. It shows us that every single action, whether it's a difficult oath sworn to a bandit queen, a doomed expedition taken alone in the desert, or a magical horse set free in the snow, echoes forward through time.
The past never stays buried.
It never does.
And for you listening, it makes you reflect on the archives of your own life. How often do we bury our own unsent letters? How often do we cling to stubborn black and white judgments to avoid the messy, nuanced truth of a situation?
More often than we'd like to admit.
We tuck these uncomfortable moments away in the back of our minds, stacking our daily distractions on top of them, hoping they'll just gather dust. But as Thomas learned the hard way, the past always, eventually, resurfaces.
The real question is, what shape will your past take when it finally catches up to you? Will it be a foundation you can build on, or a monster you have to fight?
Speaking of monsters, I want to leave you with one final, deeply chilling thought built directly from the darkest corners of the lore we've explored today.
Oh, this is the scary part.
The texts briefly mention one final, horrifying type of minion used by the Destroyer. They're called wraiths. But they aren't just generic ghosts.
No, they are much worse.
The Chronicles explicitly state that the Destroyer creates his wraiths specifically from the twisted souls of enemies who were denied a proper burial.
That is incredibly bleak.
It is. And I want you to mull over that metaphor long after you finish listening today. If we do not take the time to properly lay our history, our failures, and our past conflicts to rest, are we guaranteeing that they will be resurrected as monsters to haunt our future?